Welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Hosted by Beth Burschak, with expert advice from Jim Lang, Pittsburgh-based CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert. Jim is also the author of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. To find out more about his book, his practice, Lang Financial Group, and how to secure Jim as a speaker for your next event, visit his website at retiresecure.com. Now, get ready to talk smart money.
We are talking smart money. I'm Beth Burschak with Jim Lang, CPA, attorney, and best-selling author of not one, but two editions of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. And we have some excellent information for you tonight. This is what Jim always refers to as the best estate plan for most traditional families. It's called Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. And we have so many details to cover, but I do want to open the phone lines. So if you have a question at any point during the next hour, you can feel free to call us at 412-333-9385. Now, Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, first of all, Jim, how long have you been doing this particular type of estate plan?
We've been doing variations of it, not the exact same thing, but we've been doing variations of it for close to 25 years.
Wow. And when did you start calling it Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan?
I started calling it Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan in 2001, and that was as a result of a change in the tax law, and I sent out an email to my then 60,000 email subscribers, and that's when I got all types of media attention, Jane Bryan Quinn, Kiplinger's, Wall Street Journal, Financial Planning, etc., and I wanted to call it something.
So it's very possible that people are already familiar with the basics of this plan because it's been in so many publications. And I do want to say, if you have the book Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later, this is covered in Chapter 15. That was water. That was water being it was very heavy water being placed on the table in front of us. Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan is in Chapter 15 of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. We're going to be going through the details of exactly how this works. But I think, Jim, we should take a step back and talk about wills in general. And there's something that you call the I Love You Will. Explain exactly what that is.
All right, let's say that you are married in what I call the Leave It to Beaver marriage. That's the original husband, original wife, and you have the same kids. So I'm not talking about kids from his marriage, from his first or second marriage, or her kids from her first or second marriage. It's our kids together. So let's assume that you have, and let's even assume, to make it even more interesting, that you have grandchildren also. So let's say that you have one of these traditional families and you are planning your estate. And I would say the starting point, and this is what a lot of people don't have, but the starting point is what I call an I Love You Will. That's where the husband says, I leave everything to you, my wife. And the wife says, I leave everything to you, my husband. And in the event that something happens to both of us, it will go to our children equally. That's actually a reasonable starting point. And some of our listeners have that, and while they can do much better than that, that's at least much better than nothing.
I was going to ask you that. Is there, should everyone, and I mean everyone, have a will?
Well, I would, of course, a conservative attorney is going to naturally say everybody should have a will, but I'll go a step further. Not only is there all types of confusion and problems and money going where it's not supposed to in the event that you don't have a will, but also wills cover other areas. So just for example, let's say that you are a young couple and you don't have a penny to your name and you go against everybody's advice. You have no life insurance. You don't have anything except you do have this beautiful child, and then something, God forbid, happens to both of you. Who is going to raise that child? Do you want the state of Pennsylvania to make that decision, or do you want to make that decision? So I would say that even over and above money issues, wills are very important. And of course, I actually like a whole integrated plan that includes wills and trusts and beneficiary designations of IRAs, beneficiary designations of life insurance, etc. So the answer is yes, everybody should.
What if you're a single guy and you're broke?
Aren't a single guy and you're broke? Let's say that you're a single guy and you're broke and you're walking down the street and you get hit by a car and your life insurance pays up. Well, who's it going to pay to? So I would still say that, you know, I mean, do you want it to go to your parents? Do you want it to go to your brothers? Do you want it to go to your nieces and nephews?
So you should really make that decision in will first.
Yeah, that's right. Now there is a misconception that some people think, oh, well, if I don't have a will, the state of Pennsylvania, or if you're in a different state, because I know we have a national audience, that the state will get it. Well, you have to have a lot of people die, like your parents and your brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews and first cousins and second cousins and fourth cousins. So I'm not so worried that the state's going to get it. I'm worried that people that you might not want to get it will get it.
Okay. Now, if we move on to something that you cover in Chapter 11 in the book, the B Trust. Explain what a B Trust is.
All right. Now, I'm going to explain this, but I want everybody to know that a lot of you guys have it, and it is, in my opinion, completely inappropriate for a lot of people that have it. So if your will has something like this, and it's usually language that people don't understand. If my wife survives me by more than 60 days, an amount equal to the smallest marital deduction needed to reduce the federal estate tax on my estate to zero after full use of all other deductions, blah, 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 blah,
blah. Who interprets that?
All right. Now, let me tell you what that means in English. It means whatever the federal exemption amount is. The federal exemption amount is how much money you're allowed to pass at death without paying any taxes. This year it happens to be $3.5 million. Next year, it happens to be unlimited, and then in 2011, it goes down to $1 million. So this is a constantly changing amount.
So we don't know in the future what that amount is going to be.
No, we don't. Now, a lot of people say, well, I'm going to wait. You know, there's some discussion that 3.5 is going to be permanent. Well, even if they pass a law that says 3.5 is going to be the new number, I don't think it's going to be permanent. I think every administration, and even changes within the administration, are going to do whatever the heck they want. We've had three eliminations of the estate tax. And I think that the most honest answer is we really don't have any idea what it's going to be like at the first or second death. I think what we can say is you may or may not be in danger of an estate tax, so we have to plan accordingly. But right now it's $3.5 million. So let's say for discussion's sake that husband and wife have split their assets equally, and let's say, even just say for discussion's sake, there's $1 million total, including everything. And let's say half of it's in the husband's name and half of it's in the wife's name, and you have this B Trust in place. What it means is an amount up to but not to exceed $3.5 million is going to go into a trust. So let's say in this case it's $500,000 or roughly half the marital estate. And it goes into the trust, and this trust basically says income to spouse, right to invade principal for health, maintenance, and support. And at the second death, that is after both spouses are gone, it goes to the kids equally. And the whole point of this trust is actually to save estate taxes, not at the first death, but at the second death. So back in the old days, when the exemption amount was $600,000 and people had $1 million estate, this might have been a useful tool to avoid estate tax, because if you didn't have it and you left everything in the what I call I love you will, so you have $500,000, your wife has $500,000, you die, you leave everything to your wife, she dies, there's $1 million in her estate, well, boom, you're over the $600,000, so there's estate tax. So attorneys get all excited. Oh, boy, we have to draft a trust.
They love trust.
We love trust. Now, this happens to be one of my pet peeves. Attorneys love to draft trusts, but a lot of times it's inappropriate for the client, because the clients usually don't come in and say, my first concern is to save estate taxes. They come in and they say, at least most of them, my first concern is making sure that my wife and I are provided for the rest of our lives. That's number one. Taxes are number two. Kids are number three. But the most important thing is we want to make sure that we provide for each other. Now, if you have these traditional wills, and by the way, that is the majority will for people who have really even more than $500,000. That's the classic will. This B Trust. And there's millions of people that have these trusts. Now, I don't even think it was a great idea back then, but now it's a horrible idea for a lot of people because, A, particularly now, assets are down. B, the exemption amount at least temporarily is 3.5, and it looks like it's going to be somewhere in that neighborhood. So if you have these types of wills, what's going to happen is, I call it the cruelest trap of all. And what happens is the surviving spouse loses control of a significant portion of the marital estate. Now, right now, if you're married and you and your husband or you and your wife have full control of all your assets.
You've been working hard for years and years and years to build that up.
You've built this up, and right now you probably have a little less than you did a year ago, but whatever you have together, and you have those resources to use in any way you want. If you die with one of these traditional plans, which I know a lot of our listeners right now have that in place right now, what's going to happen is the surviving spouse is going to lose control of a significant portion of the marital assets. So they will actually be worse off than they were when their spouse was alive. And if there's an issue of Social Security reduction or a pension reduction, then you really have what could be financially devastating to a family.
So we are going to get to how to correct that problem, Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. We are going to take a quick break. It's the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Talking more smart money, I'm Beth Bershock with Jim Lang, and we are talking about the best estate plan for most traditional families, Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. By the way, if you have a question, it's 412-333-9385. Just found out, by the way, the Capitals took a 1-0 lead in the Pens game. I had to pass that on. And we were talking about the B trust in most traditional wills. And Jim, you were saying how it really can tie the hands of the surviving spouse, and you may not be able to invade principal that you used to have control over. But I'm guessing so many of these are drafted, there must be some advantages of a B trust.
Well, in today's numbers, let's say that you have a $7 million estate. Potentially, at the second death, there could be a tax on $3.5 million that could have been avoided with this B trust. So potentially, for large estates, you can save taxes well over $1 million. And I will say that the B trust has its place. The other thing is, you know, right now we're getting a little bit comfortable with the $3.5 million, but again, it's going to go to $1 million, or at least that's the way the law is right now. And as I said before, we can't predict. So maybe Congress is going to decide, hey, we need to collect some more revenue. We're going to pick on the estate tax, and they're going to lower the exemption. And it might be that you'll be very happy that you had this B trust, because it could potentially save estate taxes.
So there could be some advantages, some disadvantages.
That's right.
Either way. Advantages for children inheriting money after the first death, but we also need to include the grandchildren.
Well, let's start with the children. One of the potential alternatives to a B trust, and I actually use this in practice, is sometimes after the first death, if there is enough money, we sometimes distribute or would like the option to distribute money to the children at the first death. So let's just say, for discussion's sake, you have a significant estate of $1 million or even more than $1 million, and you have maybe two kids or three kids or whatever it might be, and the first spouse dies, and you take a look at the finances of the surviving spouse, and maybe there's a pension, and maybe there's Social Security, and maybe there's some extra money that the surviving spouse just doesn't need. It might make sense to have some money, at least a portion, after the surviving spouse is more than provided for, to go to the children after the first death. So let's say that, you know, the old man dies, there's a lot of money, more than enough money to take care of his widow, and maybe the widow is going to live 20 years, and by the way, it could go the other way too, of course, you know, she could die first and he could be the survivor. And does it really make sense to have the kids wait until they're 60 before they inherit any money? Well, in some cases, yeah, because in some cases, surviving spouse is going to need everything. But in other cases, we can reasonably predict, even after a downturn, that some money will be appropriately available to children. So what we could say sometimes is, okay, I'm going to leave $10,000, $50,000, $100,000, or whatever it might be, to each of my children after the first death, not the second death, and in certain circumstances, that is an appropriate response.
And considering that you don't know necessarily what the portfolio is going to be then, can you leave a percentage?
You can leave a percentage. In either case, it's still a little bit risky because whether you do a percentage, because to me, my big thing is I always want to make sure that both spouses are more than provided for the rest of their lives. To me, that's paramount, and that's something that I think a lot of attorneys don't do, particularly with the traditional trust. I always want to make sure that the husband and the wife are more than provided for during their lives, and then money for children, grandchildren, saving taxes is after that. So if we take that as our base, then leaving money to children or grandchildren, even though it might be appropriate, is still a little bit risky. Because what happens if, you know, nobody would have thought, let's say a year ago, that our portfolios were going to go down by 40%. The other thing is, who knows what's going to happen in the future to our portfolios, tax laws, the needs of the kids, the needs of the surviving spouse, etc.
Those are all questions. If you have a traditional estate plan, you can't answer those in advance.
Well, the traditional answer is to just take your best guess.
That's risky.
And here's the other thing about the traditional plan. The traditional plan is take your best guess, draft accordingly, and then, if and when the circumstances change, to go back and change a will. Well, a lot of times, you know, I'll meet with a new client, and I'll be reviewing their existing will, and it says, oh, you know, it says here that if something happens to both of you, little Johnny goes to Aunt Sue for a guardian. By the way, how old is little Johnny? Oh, he's 47.
Right. So I know a lot of people in that situation who haven't updated their will in a long, long time.
So that happens all the time. And rather than fight that, although certainly as a prudent attorney would tell you that these should be updated more often, rather than fight that, I would rather prepare a will that has a long shelf life. So in the event that you don't get around to reviewing it or changing it, what you did 5, 10, 20 years ago might still hold up. And if you're going to do these, the traditional plan or the fixed in stone or X percent to the kids or X percent to the grandkids or even X dollars to the kids or the grandkids, it's a little bit risky just because so many things could change.
We do have a solution, though, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But before we do, I want to take a quick break. But could you tell us how often you think or when everyone should review their will?
Well, the traditional answer is probably every 3 years, and I hate to let my clients relax and get off the hook a little bit, but frankly, the plans that we draft literally have a longer shelf life, considerably longer. So some of the plans that we did 5, 10, even 15 years ago really are fine, and I would say most of my reviews that I have with my existing estate clients, we tend to not change the documents. We might change the strategy. We might do a Roth IRA conversion. We might do something in terms of which dollars we spend first. We might do a gift. We might do a number of strategic things. And maybe if there's a change in the family, we would perhaps do an update or a codicil. But we don't tend to change the base plan, which we're going to get to.
Which is because you have built in the longevity into that plan.
We've built in tremendous flexibility, and that's ultimately going to be the key to the cascading beneficiary plan is flexibility.
And we're going to let you in on that secret coming up. It is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
And thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Beth Burschak along with Jim Lang. We are talking about the best estate plan for most traditional families, Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. And before we get to the secret with Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, I want to tell you about a couple of seminars we have coming up. You do cover Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan in the seminars, so you can hear some of this live. We have one coming up next Saturday, May 16th, and this is from the same workshop is happening twice, so you can pick the time. 9:30 to 11:30 or 1 to 3. This is at Four Points by Sheraton, Pittsburgh North. This is our first venture up into Mars. And if you would like to register for that, call 1-800-748-1571. Just please tell us which of those you would like to attend. And then we are going to be back at one of our favorite locations, Crown Plaza South, which is right across from South Hills Village, on Saturday, June 20th. Again, two times, 9:30 to 11:30, 1 to 3. If you want to register for that, please call 412-521-2732. That's the number to our office. So for the June 20th location at Crown Plaza, call 412-521-2732. And if you want to sign up for next Saturday, which is May 16th, call 1-800-748-1571. Mostly this is about the Roth. Its two new tax laws create shocking opportunities for wealth preservation. We talk about Roth IRAs, Roth IRA conversions, but you do get in some of the estate plan for Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. And we're going to let you in on what that's all about in just a second. But if we could get back to the grandchildren for a second, Jim.
Well, one of the things, you know, up to now we've mainly been talking wills, but a lot of times the will is not the most important document. A lot of times the most important document, or even the revocable trust, for a lot of my clients, the most important document is actually the beneficiary designation of the IRA or the retirement plan or the 403B, 401K, 457, SEP, KEO, etc. Because remember, it isn't your will that controls what happens to your retirement plan when you die. It's actually the retirement plan beneficiary designation. So what a lot of people have done is they have 10, 20, 30-page wills. It has all kinds of complications. But if you actually look at where their money is, it's in their IRA or retirement plan, and that's often a two-line designation, my spouse first, my kids equally second, and that's certainly inadequate for a whole bunch of reasons. So first, I think we have to consider where the money is coming from. We have to cover every single asset, whether it be a retirement plan, a life insurance policy, an annuity, whatever it might be, and make sure that it's either controlled by the will, revocable trust, or beneficiary designation. But in answer to your question, we also, when considering who to leave money to, there are some big advantages to leaving money to children or even grandchildren if you leave money in an IRA to them. And we're not going to have time to really thoroughly examine what are called the stretch IRA or inherited IRA rules, but let's just put it this way. Most of my clients don't take money from their IRA or in their retirement plan until they're 70 years old, when they have to. That's when they have the minimum required distributions, which, by the way, are suspended for this year, which is one of the great fabulous opportunities to take advantage of proactively. Don't do, just do nothing. Consider a Roth IRA conversion. But anyway, that's a little bit outside the scope of this. If a child or a grandchild inherits an IRA or a Roth IRA, they will be required to take money from that inherited IRA or inherited Roth IRA, but typically at a much slower rate than their parents. So let's say, you know, the old man dies, or the spouse dies, and the surviving spouse could take everything. Well, they might have to take it on a much faster time period than a child, or since a grandchild is so much younger. And if we're going to oversimplify, let's say a grandchild has a 40-year life expectancy. All right, well, in that case, then they would have to take roughly 2.5% of the IRA. So on $100,000, they'd have to take a $2,500 distribution. A surviving spouse would have to take a higher distribution. A child would have to take a higher one, but not as high as the surviving spouse. So we can defer more money, or in the case of a Roth, we can get more tax-free money by having younger beneficiaries. And sometimes the children, or perhaps one child, doesn't need the money. So let's say, for discussion's sake, that you have a situation where you have two children and one of them makes a lot of money and the other one doesn't make a lot of money. You could have conflicting goals within the family. The one who makes a lot of money might say, hey, we have plenty of money. What I'd rather do is I'd rather have that money go to my kids, that is the grandchild of the person that died, have low minimum required distributions, have income tax deferred, or in the case of a Roth IRA, income tax free money growing for the next 40, 60, 80 years. So sometimes leaving money to a grandchild, whether it be, and typically, by the way, you're always going to leave money to a, or it's prudent to leave money to a grandchild or any young minor in some type of trust that might say health, maintenance, support, education, postgraduate education, down payment for a home, seed money for a business, one-third when you're 25, one-third when you're 30, we terminate the trust at 35. It might be something like that. But it might be very appropriate to leave some money to a grandchild, particularly if there is at least one wealthy child in the family.
And you're saying you could do that by the beneficiary designation of your IRA. What happens, Jim, if the beneficiary designation that you made for your IRA is not applicable at some point? For instance, let's say you named a beneficiary and then they were deceased and you never updated it.
Well, that's a real good question. So let's say for discussion's sake that you have two kids and your two kids have two kids and you just have a very simple beneficiary designation. I leave everything to my spouse, and if my spouse isn't alive, I leave everything to my children equally. Which is very common. I leave everything to my spouse, and if my spouse isn't alive, to my children equally. And let's say that one of your children die, but is survived by grandchildren.
Right, which happens.
Yeah, do you know how much the grandchildren get?
How much?
Zero.
Are you serious?
Yeah, you just effectively cut out your grandchild, so your children. So not only do these poor grandchildren not have a parent, but they also are deprived of anything that the child would have inherited.
So you have to pay attention.
You have to really pay attention, and I can't tell you how common that is, and people think that they're covered, and there does happen to be a quick fix to that. I almost hate to say it, because I'm afraid somebody's just going to put that down and think they're okay, and they're really not. The quick fix, by the way, is to use the word per stirpes, P-E-R space S-T-I-R-P-E-S. And that basically says that the children of the predeceased child would get what the predeceased child gets. So in that situation where you had one of the children die, survived by children, the surviving grandchildren would get what the deceased child would get.
So you really have to pay attention, beneficiary designation. Now, when you were talking about traditional estate plans, and we were talking about all of the variables that you cannot predict, you can't predict the portfolio amounts or the needs of the family or who will die first. So what is your solution?
Well, here's the ultimate problem. The ultimate problem, I'm getting to the solution. I just want to agitate people a little bit and tell you what the problem is. The problem is we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the estate tax law is going to be like in 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years. We don't know what the portfolio is going to be like. And we might make a prediction, and I will tell you that I've done a lot of projections in the last 30 years, and none of them have come true. Something went awry. The wrong spouse died first. Everybody thought he was going to die, and it turned out she died. Everybody thought there was going to be more money, and there was less money. Everybody thought there was going to be less money, and there's more money. Whatever I thought was going to happen, something else happened. So anytime, and I usually discourage this, but anytime I have done a traditional fixed in stone type will, it often doesn't work out well for the family. And the other thing is sometimes we don't know the needs of the surviving spouse. So let's say that you have, we up to now have, by the way, mentioned four choices. The first choice was we were going to leave everything to the surviving spouse to start, all right, in our I love you wills. The second choice that we talked about was the B trust, which is, by the way, called the exemption equivalent trust, the Unified Credit Shelter Trust. It goes by a number of different names, but that's the trust that says income to spouse, right to invade principal for health, maintenance, and support, and if the second death, it goes to the kids equally. Then we also talked about leaving money to grandchildren equally. And then the last thing that we talked about was leaving money to grandchildren, and we were even more specific and said if we leave money to a minor, we want to leave it in a minor in some type of trust, because we don't want the minor to go have a party when they're 18 or 21, depending on what state you live in. So this is the problem, that we have all these choices. We don't know what we should be doing because we can't predict the future. And the traditional answer is take your best shot, take your best guess, draft accordingly, and hope it flies.
That sounds kind of risky.
And I think it is risky. Now, in order to use my proposed solution to this problem, it is imperative that something be established.
Okay. Which is what?
And right now, I know that a lot of my clients who are listening know exactly what's coming. And this is the point in the meeting when I turn to, and it doesn't matter the order, but I turn to the husband or I turn to the wife and I say, do you trust your spouse?
And you say that in front of the spouse. So
I do say that in front of the spouse.
There's really no other answer except, yes, I do.
With all due respect, there has been other answers.
Really?
Yeah.
In front of the spouse?
In front of the spouse. So if there isn't perfect trust between spouses, then what I'm going to tell you is probably not applicable. All right? So I need to have the spouses trust each other, which is why one of the reasons why this doesn't work well for second spouses with different children. It doesn't work well if, you know, I've had situations where one spouse, typically the wife, wants all the money to go to the kids and grandkids, and perhaps the husband thinks a large portion should go to a charity. I have other situations where one spouse wants a lot of money to go to the grandkids and the other spouse wants it to go to the kids, or one spouse wants more to go to one kid than to go to another child.
So they have to be on the same page.
With this plan, you need people to be on the same page. But let's assume that, and usually I get a little joke and, oh yeah, you know, we've been married 40 years and, you know, if I can't trust them now and blah, blah, blah. So let's assume that we can get by that. And I'm also going to talk about the weakness of my plan, too. But first, I'm going to talk about the strength. But if we can get by that, then here is what my decision on what people should have in their wills or what decision they should make right now.
Okay, what decision should they make?
Don't decide.
Well, there you go. There's got to be
you don't decide.
There's got to be some explanation to that, though. Eventually have to decide.
You eventually have to decide, but here's what I think makes a lot more sense. I think that rather than deciding right now, when we don't know who's going to die first, we don't know what the exemption amount's going to be, we don't know what the needs of the surviving children, grandchildren, spouse, etc. are, if we trust the surviving spouse to make that decision, presumably with help from counsel, whether it be a financial advisor or an attorney or both or whatever, we let the surviving spouse make that decision, and we can draft these documents in such a way that the surviving spouse would have 9 months to make that decision after the date of death. So if we have spouses that trust each other, if we have, again, to keep it simple, those four choices of surviving spouse, be trust, children, or grandchildren, now you have to get this set up now. You can't just say, okay, I'll use my existing documents and then we'll decide later. The documents must be set up properly now. So if you had the traditional documents and you want to implement this plan, it would absolutely fail and it would come crashing down miserably. But if you get them redrafted using Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan or a very similar type of flexible estate plan, then what you can do is you can have the surviving spouse make that decision of who gets what, not now, but within 9 months after the first death.
And what happens during those 9 months? What if the spouse needs principal to live on in those 9 months?
Well, the default... Let's say the default of the plan that I recommend is the surviving spouse gets everything.
Okay.
All right, so let's say the worst case, there's a death, the surviving spouse goes into a drunken stupor, can't deal with anything, can't deal with attorneys, can't even think about it. And 10 months later, they wake up and they say, okay, you know, now I'm ready to take care of business. In that case, everything will go to them.
And then they can still make other decisions. Well,
they're they can make other decisions. It would be limited. It would be much better if on the eighth month, the last day, and actually typically people are doing this, they're at least starting the process in the first or second month. And I never rush people in this decision. And here's what happens in the real world, all right? Because, you know, our firm is 30 years old. The law firm is 25 years old, which is relatively young. And that's because I didn't buy the practice and I didn't inherit the practice. I actually started it on my own. So most of my clients are still kicking. But we've had quite a few deaths. And here's what happens in the real world. At some point, maybe within the first month or two, the surviving spouse will come to my office, typically accompanied by one of the adult children, sometimes more than one, but typically at least one, who provide both technical and emotional support. And I will attempt to lay out all the choices. I'll repeat what was actually drafted. And by the way, it's really good to know what is in your wills and in your trusts. In our office, we actually write a letter that describes in English,
which is helpful,
what your wills and trusts say. But the surviving spouse will come in, and then we can go over options, and then sometimes we run numbers. Sometimes it's frankly immediately obvious. Sometimes you do a little bit of each. That is, sometimes you might have a surviving spouse says, well, I want X number of dollars or X percent on my own. I want so much money to go into the B trust. I want so much going to the kids, and I want so much going to the grandkids. And frankly, I sometimes help people with that. I'm going to err on over-providing for the surviving spouse, even at the cost of some taxes down the road. That's the way, if I had to make a mistake or a lack of judgment, I'm going to make that lack of judgment or err in over-providing for the surviving spouse. But using this flexible approach, we get a much better result because we have a lot more information to make a decision on. We know what the value of the portfolio is. We know what the exemption amount is. We know what the needs of the kids and the grandkids are. And in that case, we can make a much better decision. And frankly, I actually believe that my model, which is this, you know, Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, and by the way, in the literature, and it's all over the literature, you sometimes see it in two different forms. One, you see it as Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, and the other one, shockingly enough, you just see it as plain old Cascading Beneficiary Plan.
That is shocking.
And that's because the snooty peer review articles in the Wall Street Journal won't let me call it Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan.
Well, we are calling it Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. It's in the book Retire Secure as Lang's Cascading Beneficiary
and
Plan.
The one that I came up, I'm the first guy who put it in publications, and this goes all the way back to an article I published in 1998.
And we are going to give you some more details on exactly how this works coming up. It's the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
We are talking specifically tonight about Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, which, if you have the book Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later, you can get the whole big description in Chapter 15. It is what Jim calls the best estate plan for most traditional families. I'm Beth Burschak with Jim Lang. And if you have a question about Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, we're on for about another 15 minutes, 412-333-9385. Jim, you said that you've been using a version of Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan in your private practice for about 25 years or so. How has this actually worked practically in real life, Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan?
In real life, it has worked exceedingly well in terms of getting money to where the surviving spouse wants it. And in the vast majority of cases, it has proven to be a wise choice. Now, there was one, and this is a potential weakness to the plan. I'm going to tell you one other weakness later on. There was one situation where, I'm going to oversimplify, the husband had $3 million in his retirement plan, and he said, you know, I'm going to do this flexible plan. And as soon as he died, and it's a funny thing, but I remember what people have. Like, if I see somebody on the street, I'll say, oh, yeah, that's the guy with $1.6 million.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah.
This just hit you?
Well, yeah, I'll say, oh, yeah, that's the guy who has $1.6 million and the no-good son-in-law. He doesn't want to get one red cent of his money. So I remember these things, and I heard the client died, and, of course, it's always sad when a client dies. But one thing I like about my practice is I like doing long-term planning, and then when there is an event like a death or a retirement or some kind of life-changing event, it's really satisfying to me to have set it up properly in the first place and then go through the process with people. Well, I already knew what I was going to do. This was back in the days when the exemption was $1 million. $2 million for the surviving spouse was going to be way more than she was ever going to spend because she was not a spender. She was a saver, like, frankly, a lot of my clients. And between her Social Security and her pension and the $2 million was way more than she needed. So my plan was I was going to have $1 million go to her children and grandchildren, and she was going to get everything else. And we were going to end up saving $1 million from a combination of income taxes on the inherited IRA, inherited Roth IRA, and estate taxes when she died. And, you know, I go through my analysis when I finally met her, and I thought for sure she would take my advice. And she said, no, I want the whole $3 million. And I went, what? I said, oh, no, Mrs. X, you don't understand. I really think it would be better. And I went through the explanation again. She said, no, I think I want the whole thing. And I said, no, but Mrs. X. And she said, no, you don't understand. It's my choice. I want it all.
Which, frankly, is true. It was her choice. But that's what happens with your plan. The surviving spouse does get to decide, and if they decide they want all of the money, then they get all of the money.
That's right. So it's a double-edged sword. Now, I've had situations where the surviving spouse has taken all the money, and perhaps the husband might not have intended that, given the amount of money that was left. So I've had surviving spouses who all of a sudden upgraded their lifestyle a little bit. But that's what they wanted, and that's part of the deal. So...
And then at that point, do you restructure another plan? If, let's say that in that particular example, the surviving spouse said, I'm taking this all. Do you restructure another plan on her death?
Well, there really isn't all that. Most of the planning, you know, really, if she now has $3 million other than gifting, yeah, of course she's going to leave it to her kids and grandkids in most cases, but they're... She's going to be more resistant to gifts and things like that, with that type of mentality. So sometimes you're playing in effect catch up if you try to do something at that point rather than the first point. Now, on the other hand, the vast majority of these where we have set up flexible accounts have been very favorable, and we get the result. We provide or over provide for the surviving spouse, which is goal number one. We save taxes if necessary, which is between that and getting money to children and grandchildren. We safeguard money for grandchildren. We don't have these grandkids get a party when they're 21. We also set up things that are not anticipated in traditional plans. So, for example, let's say you have a wealthy child and the child doesn't want or need all the money. You can have, in my plan, you could actually have the parent be the trustee for the grandkids, where most plans anticipate the only way the grandkids are going to get the money is if the child predeceases. So there's a lot of flexibility, and it has worked out very well in practice. Now, the traditional plan sometimes has not. I had an engineer, and of course they always think they're smarter than I am. Not always. That's not fair.
There are probably many engineers listening this evening.
I have a lot of engineers and quantitative types as clients. And anyway, this guy did his own investments, and of course he thought he was an investment genius. And he did the traditional plan, figuring, well, I'm going to die with X amount of money, and if my surviving spouse gets the income from that, that should be more than enough. Well, they did their own investments. The investments went way down. Then he died, and money, instead of going to the surviving spouse outright, ended up going into this trust. And the surviving spouse... Do they have health maintenance and support? Sure. But sometimes the surviving spouse wants more than health maintenance and support.
And who determines health maintenance and support?
Well, that's the trustee, which is another problem of the traditional plan. depending on who the trustee is, whether a lot of times it's a bank. I tend to use family members as trustees, but I'm not sure that I want my fate determined by a trustee, even if it is a family member. So I would say, in general, the results have been very favorable in terms of adding flexibility for the surviving spouse and for the family after a first death.
I want to get back to the cascade for a second. Let's just say, here's an example. Does the cascade continue on? Say, for instance, the surviving spouse says, I don't really need all this money. I want to pass this on to my children. What if the children then say, I don't really need this money? Can they pass it on?
Yes, they can.
So you can, the cascade can actually continue.
Right. The surviving spouse, ultimately the surviving spouse is the boss, but you could have money going to the surviving spouse, you could have money going to the betrothed, you could have money going to children equally, or you could have money going to grandchildren or some combination. You could also have money going to, let's say, grandchildren in one situation of one family, but to the children of the other family. So let's say, you know, one is very wealthy and they're more interested in the security of their children, that is the grandchildren of the person who died first. They can do that. And let's say the other one is a struggling single parent, and they'd say, well, I'd love to have some money for my kids, but right now I just need the money for myself. So you have that flexibility built in, which I think is so important, because I hate trying to predict the future, being wrong and getting a bad result. I would much rather say, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to put all the good options in the wills and the trusts and the IRA beneficiary designation, insurance beneficiary designation, etc. And then when the event comes, I am set up to do whatever seems appropriate at that time.
It's Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. We are going to wrap it up in a few minutes. It is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Talking more smart money, I'm Beth Bershock with Jim Lang. We just have a few minutes left, and we've been talking about Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, which Jim calls the best estate plan for most traditional families. If you have the book Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later, you can get all of the info in Chapter 15, and actually there's a very cool flow chart in there that shows you Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. Jim, what if you're dealing with someone who is already a widow or a widower? How would that work in practice?
Well, even then, you still want to allow flexibility. Now, a B trust is not going to be appropriate for a widow or a widower because there is no surviving spouse in that situation that you would leave money to. You would presumably be leaving money to children or grandchildren. But even with the Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, what you could do, as opposed to, let's say, a traditional plan, is you can let each child decide whether they want to keep their share. So let's say you have simple situation, two kids, and each of the two kids have two kids. You could have each kid decide whether they want to keep their share of what they inherit, or whether they wanted to, the legal word is disclaim, or say, I don't want, and you have the paperwork flow so that the money goes into a trust for the grandchildren of, and by the way, each child is going to want their money, or the money that would have gone to them, to go to them, not their niece, to their kids, not their nieces and nephews. So you still have this, let's call it a variation of Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, and I'm a big fan of that. Now, interestingly enough, even after a death, if you had the original Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan, you probably don't even have to redo your documents. They're probably...
So it is...
It works just fine.
And in this case, or the example that you just gave, there's more than one survivor making this decision. You make the decision for you, I make the decision for me, but it's all under the same flexible plan.
Right. So let's say you have 10 kids, and five of them are rich and five of them are broke. The five that are rich can say, okay, I want my portion to go to my kids. The other thing that's really important that I didn't mention is that you can have a partial. So you could have, let's say, some money going to the grandkids and some money just going to each kid.
If you decide you want to keep part of it.
Right.
So you're saying, I'm going to keep part of this, but I also want my kids to have some of this.
Right.
And that's all part of the plan.
Yes, it is.
It's whatever you want to do.
It's very flexible.
It is very flexible.
Now, to be fair, it has to be set up ahead of time.
You can't do this after the death. You can't suddenly jump in there and say, we want to do Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan. It has to be set up.
It has to be set up. Now I'm not going to say that I'm the only attorney that can do it, because obviously other people can. And I'll also say that there was an article. This was first published in the Wall Street Journal, I think back around 2001. And then subsequently they did another article saying that flexibility in estate planning has dramatically increased in the United States. Now, I'd like to be so vain as to think that I'm the cause of it, but...
That's okay. Take credit.
Well, no. maybe I'll take a little contribution, but there's other variations, and there's obviously other attorneys that are building in some flexibility, and it just makes sense.
And I do want to say, though, if you have questions about this and you want to contact the office, it's 412-521-2732 in Squirrel Hill. Two workshops coming up. We want to make sure you know about these. One is next Saturday, May 16th. We do cover Lang's Cascading Beneficiary Plan in the workshop. It also deals with two new tax laws creating shocking opportunities for wealth preservation. Two times next Saturday, 9:30 to 11:30 in the morning, 1 to 3 in the afternoon. This is at Four Points by Sheridan, Pittsburgh North. If you want to RSVP for that, I would do it soon. It's 1-800-748-1571. 1-800-748-1571. It answers 24 hours a day, by the way. And the one on June 20th, which is also a Saturday, Crown Plaza South, which is right across from South Hills Village. And Jim, you wanted to make an offer. We have about 1 minute left. Five free books, is that what we want to do? Five free books?
Sure.
Okay, this is Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. Everything that you heard tonight is in the book. So how are we going to do it? This is for five people, the first five people that contact us.
First five people that would either call our office, and by the way, you can even just leave it on the answering machine, as long as you give us all your contact information at 412-521-2732. We will include a copy of the book. And we will also include a special article called The Ideal Beneficiary Designation of Your Retirement Plan.
I'm going to give the website or the email, too. How about that? It's the first five people. You can either do beth@paytaxeslater.com or 412-521-2732. And if you want to leave a voicemail, you can do it at extension 219, and we'll take care of that in the first five people. You'll get a free copy of the book. Oh, also, the workshops, you also get a free copy of the book. So that's another reason to attend the workshop, too, in addition to all of the great information. Back in 2 weeks, and we are going to be joined by Bob Keebler, who is really one of the country's top IRA experts. He's going to be our guest, the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Portions of the audio that you just heard will be posted online at retiresecure.com. You can also find a list of upcoming events and topics at retiresecure.com. To see Lang personally or to speak to a member of his dedicated staff at Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, call 412-521-2732. Join us again in 2 weeks when we talk more smart money.